There was a time not that long ago when people had to be convinced that our climate was changing. But now, with record-setting hot summers, devastating storms, and droughts on the rise, the conversation has shifted to how do we stop it?
We need to confront the deep tensions between the systems that we've designed and the actual feasibility of the biocapacity of the Earth. They're not aligned. And we are overshooting. With our economic systems, we're in overshoot.
In this episode, Kate Raworth talks about her alternative model known as donut economics, which places economic objectives within the social and ecological boundaries of the living planet.
So we need to see cities actually ensuring that the resources that we have, the water, the materials, the carbon that we are using, are used to provide common access goods for all.
Kate Raworth's book, Donut Economics, Seven Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist, was a bestseller, and several cities around the world are applying her ideas. Raworth teaches at Oxford University's Environmental Change Institute and at the Amsterdam University of Applied Sciences. Journalist Rhoda Metcalf spoke with Kate Raworth as part of our Women in Economics series.
So, I mean, you've gained renown for developing an interesting economic model. Can you lay it out for us? I mean, what's the basic premise of your model and what is it trying to achieve?
It's called donut economics. It really is like a donut, the cone with a hole in the middle. And that's because the image of a donut, two concentric circles, to me is very visually important shape of progress. We've inherited from 20th century economics an economics in which the shape of progress has never actually drawn, it's never actually explicitly discussed in the classroom, but it lies behind every politician's speech and every economist's advice, which is a line of ever-rising growth measured in GDP. So it's the exponential growth function. Donut economics flips that and says, no, we need to explicitly start with a goal which is about thriving, meeting the needs of all people within the means of the living planet. And that's drawn in the shape of a donut. We want to leave nobody in the hole in the middle, falling short on life's essentials, but we mustn't overshoot the limits of Earth's capacities around the outside. So instead of aiming for endless growth, we aim to thrive within the means of the living planet. And that changes everything. That changes everything that follows.
So how does growth fit into your model? I mean, is growth unnecessary in the model that you're creating, or how does that work?
So first of all, I want to step back and think philosophically about growth. Growth, as a concept, is a wonderful, healthy phase of life. But in our own lives and relations, we deeply, intuitively, biologically understand that when something tries to grow endlessly inside a delicately balanced living system, that is a threat to the health of the whole. So healthy living systems go through a rapid phase of growth, and then they mature and they grow up. So now let's bring this back to economics.
Yeah.
Low-income countries, take Malawi, they've around $1,500 per person per capita. I mean, it's appallingly low. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can get everybody out of that hole in the donut on such a low income. Of course they need economic growth, but they need that growth to be channeled into investing in people's rights to health and education and housing. So we need to see growth for sure in low-income countries. But the history of growth has been that as countries have got richer, instead of channeling that money merely into ensuring that nobody's falling short, long before most people are out of the hole in the middle of the donut, what happens is the additional income in that country is being actually channeled into ecological overshoot. We see countries overshooting their share of carbon budgets, water, materials, their footprint overshoots. So we have actually a history of a degenerative and divisive growth pathway. That's what the 20th century has bequeathed us. Mm-hmm. Just getting richer is not taking a country into the donut. In fact, the richest countries in the world have shot way past the donut. They may have fewer people living in poverty, although some of them have extremely high levels of inequality still, but they are way overshooting their share of planetary boundaries. In fact, the country in the world that's closer than any other to living in the donut, still not there, but it's closer, it's Costa Rica. Nearly meeting people's needs almost within the means of the planet. And that should give all countries hope that it could be possible if we actually aim to do it.
Right. I mean, I think one of the things that I find really interesting about your model is the idea that several cities around the world have actually embraced it. And what is it like to live in a city based on donut economics?
So there's over 80 towns, cities, councils, villages, up to states that have publicly said, we are using the tools of donut economics to reimagine our future here. So Amsterdam was the first city to adopt the framework. Now, their goal for circularity is to have, for example, no fossil fuel vehicles in the city by 2030. Boats, trucks, cars, no fossil fuel vehicles. And already, actually, when I go to Amsterdam, you can see that's a city that's moving. Right? Every time I visit, there's more alternative kinds of transport coming in, as people would be crazy to buy a fossil fuel car there. Of course, cities aren't in charge of everything that matters where they are. They can maybe raise a city tax, they can change the transport system, but they're, of course, part of a national system, so there's a lot of things they can't change. Sure. But I would say a city like Grenoble in France, they've introduced a wealth tax in the region because they said this makes sense. We want this to be a more equitable city, and this is supported by the residents of place, as part of many, many changes that they're bringing about in the city in terms of transport, in terms of bringing in tree cover, making these really habitable, desirable places to be. The city of Barcelona is one of the cities that's also using the framework. And I think that happens because within every jurisdiction, there's somebody in it. It comes back to people, right? There are people who want to bring about a transformation locally, and they see the concepts of donut economics. How can we enable everybody here to thrive within the means of the planet in a way that doesn't undermine the thriving opportunities for people elsewhere? And so they've introduced the tools as part of their city transformation. So they're on that journey. They're beginning. They're beginning to gather new metrics that are reflecting the city through the donut rather than saying, what's our city GDP? They're beginning to look at how they need to collaborate within the city departments. And it's got real clarity that the tools are bringing people together in a way that they didn't work together before. It's breaking silos and getting people to work together.
But can you give me an example of how this works? I mean, what are some of the characteristics of donut? What would we see happen in the city that is trying to adhere to and, you know, form its policies based on the principles of donut economics? What kind of things happen?
Right. So cities are starting off by creating a portrait of the city as it is, and then to bring themselves into the donut space. First, they're going to focus on deprivation in the locality, which is a very familiar space for a city to focus on. Who is not able to meet their food or health or housing or transport or educational needs? How do we bring them up? We would focus on local ecology of the place, the quality of air, the quality of the water. And these are really key attributes, actually, in times of climate change, when we know we are living in a less stable climate world. Mm-hmm. How do we bring the qualities of locally nature's ecosystems, nature's forests or wetlands into our cities? How do we cool the air on a hot day instead of having an urban heat island effect? Because the forest next door knows how to do that. How do we store carbon instead of release it? How do we absorb groundwater instead of being hit by flash flooding? So a city would ensure that its local ecology was healthy so that it was going to be far more resilient to climate impacts. But these, so far I've just described the local policies, right? And it's going to improve lives for people here. But we also need to recognize that every place is dependent upon the rest of the world. If you just think about the clothes we wear, the food we eat, who assembled our phones, and what's all the materials in these things? So how do we reduce our footprint on the world, the material and carbon, energy, water footprint? And that's how do we come back within planetary boundaries? This is the real tough challenge. How do we decarbonize cities? But also how do we create a far more circular and restorative use of the materials that are already there rather than drawing endlessly on global supply chains? And recognize that cities have impacts on people worldwide. So it's about recognizing we're trying to transform the local conditions of living, but also not doing that in a way that actually amplifies damage and impact on people elsewhere. And that's crucial because no one city alone can say, we're living in the donut, whatever else is happening to the rest of you. It's about the interconnection of the world.
So, I mean, as I understand it, your model relies on moving away from the classic conception of the rational economic person optimizing their own self-interest to a different take on human behavior and motivation. So how does that work?
So if we're going to seek to meet the needs of all people within the means of the planet, then I think we need to transform the way we think as economists. And that's why the subtitle of my book is Seven Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. It's a new way of thinking.
Okay.
And one of those is to leave behind the teaching that's still far too dominant, in my view, in universities to students of who we are, the model of humanity, which is still predicated so much on rational economic man. with these attributes of being competitive, self-interested, insatiable, hating work, loving luxury. Of course, behavioral economics has gone far beyond this, but these traits still underpin many mainstream macroeconomic models.
Okay.
There is absolutely no chance of humanity thriving, 8 to 10 billion people together on this planet, if we continue to tell ourselves that that is who we are. So I think we need to move from the story of rational economic man, which isn't underpinned by science. We need to move to actually empirically grounded research from evolutionary biologists, cognitive behavioral scientists who say, no, we are actually pro-social. We are the most social of all mammals. We are interdependent and reciprocal. We tend to reciprocate and collaborate with others so long as they tend to collaborate with us. And when we tap into those traits, we give ourselves a very different spaces in which to behave. So instead of assuming that we will meet in markets in a highly competitive dog-eat-dog approach, we can actually see our behaviors collaborative. It brings new attention to actually different kinds of market behaviors, collaborative market behaviors. So worker-owned enterprises, cooperatively owned enterprises, we can bring collaboration into spaces that use market mechanisms.
So tell me a bit about the kind of research you did before you developed this model. I mean, how did the previous work you have done lead you to it?
So what really led me to it goes all the way back to 1990s when I was a student. I went to university to study economics because I wanted to master the mother tongue of public policy. I wanted to help tackle the kinds of issues that I'd grown up seeing happening in the world as a teenager of the 1980s, like a famine in Ethiopia, a hole in the ozone layer, talk of a greenhouse effect. So I was very motivated by social and environmental justice. And I thought an economics degree would be the equipment I needed to help tackle that. But
So you thought you should follow the money on these issues?
Well, it wasn't the money, because economics is, you know, it literally means the art of household management. It's the tools of public policy. If anything, I definitely wasn't motivated by the money. I was much more interested in courses on public policy. But there was no course on offer. This was Oxford University in the early 1990s. There was no course on environmental economics or policy, let alone ecological economics. There just wasn't a course on offer. I had to study public policy to get to study 1 week about what happens if a company drops gloop in the river. How will you tax it or set a quota? So it was really minimal. And I gradually realized through my degree that the living world was just absent from economics. That you could actually graduate, whether from Oxford or from any university, in economics and study nothing of the living world and actually specialize in following the money and go into banking and finance.
Right.
And contribute to the utter degradation of the planet on which every life depends. And to me, that's the fundamental that brings me back. And also social justice was really missing. I wanted to come back into economics and put these at the center of it. I actually walked away from economics after doing a master's degree in development economics. So I walked away from it and I immersed myself in the real world economy. I worked for 3 years in the Ministry of Trade and Industry in Zanzibar. I then worked for 4 years on the Human Development Report at the UN, UNDP's Human Development Report, and had the honor of working directly with Amartya Sen and Mahbub ul Haq and others. So reframing from economic development to human development, and this centered human beings. So that made a lot of sense to me, but no mention of the degradation of the living world. So this really rankled with me. I went from the UN to Oxfam, where I worked for over a decade on all sorts of campaigns connecting global trade and global systems with the impact in people's lives. And then I became a mother. I had twins and I was nursing two babies right in the middle of the global financial crash in 2009. And I remember, you know, the world's economists then came out and said, oh, we need to rewrite economics to reflect financial realities. And I just remember sitting there with these babies thinking, I'll be damned if we're only going to rewrite economics to reflect that. Where is the planet? Where is social injustice? We need to put all of these things at the center. So when I went back to work after maternity leave, a colleague in my team at Oxfam said, oh, here is some great research that's come out the last year. And I saw this diagram of 9 planetary boundaries. It was a circle with red rays shooting out over the edge of the circle. Earth system scientists saying these 9 planetary boundaries, like the climate system and ocean acidification and biodiversity and water withdrawals, these are the ecological cycles that make Earth the only known livable, thriving planet. And we are overshooting. With our economic systems, we're in overshoot. I had a rush of adrenaline through me saying, this to me is the beginning of 21st century economics, and I want to bring as they've brought ecological outer limits, I drew a circle within their circle and said, these are the social inner limits of human rights.
Right.
And so it became a two concentric circles. I showed it to somebody and said, someone said, oh, that's a donut. It came out of a doodle on the back of an envelope. But I was really struck by how many people were inspired, empowered, motivated by seeing an image. They said, this represents how I've always thought of it. I've not seen the picture before. And this empowers me in making a different case.
So I'm curious. I can only imagine that it's not easy for anyone to bring a pretty radical new economic model out into the world. Mm-hmm. At the same time that economics is still at least somewhat male-dominated field. So what's it been like for you as a woman to take this model out into the world?
Well, the obvious is I don't know because I never tried to take it out as a man. So that's one answer.
Fair enough.
But it's a fair question. First thing that comes to my mind is that many of the people who've inspired me have been other women. Some of them economists, I'm going to say Stephanie Kelton, Mariana Mazzucato, Jayati Ghosh. So there's a kind of sisters rising, which is great. And we collaborate, by the way, and we've shared on Twitter pictures of us holding up each other's books in a way that a lot of people said, I really appreciate that. You're not competing. Again, we're not rational economic man, right? We're celebrating each other's work. But I do think that it's relevant that people other than, let's say, wealthy men from the global north, who are all the founding fathers. When you look back at the founding fathers of economics, right, they were all rich white men from the global north. And I don't think it's coincidental that what they saw and what they put at the center of their theories and what they ignored. So Adam Smith, talking about, you know, who makes your dinner, is it the butcher, the brewer, or the baker? He forgot to mention his mother.
Right.
And it took, you know, 200 years for feminist economists to come and put feminist economics and the unpaid caring household at the center of our vision.
Yep.
So you need different perspectives, I think. So bringing the ideas as a woman, I really enjoy celebrating that I'm also bringing it alongside people bringing it from the global south, bringing a decolonial perspective, people bringing other views. I'm also, as you can tell from my life story, my career story, I haven't done this from within academia. I chose to move outside of academia. I didn't write academic articles and I didn't write a textbook. I wrote a trade book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might have been part of what's given it some traction. It's almost like coming from left field. By the way, I often show up with cobble cutouts and donuts and toys, and I use hosepipe to talk about growth. And this is a bit different from a purely academic approach to argument, because I think economics is really intimidating for most people.
Yeah.
When I was writing my book, I would meet parents at the school gate who'd say, what do you do? I said, I'm writing a book about rewriting economics. Most people lean backwards and they say, I wasn't very good at maths at school. And I said, well, in my book, the only numbers are the page numbers. So we can all do this. And let's make economics accessible in a language that means everybody can realize it's a political conversation and they all have a claim to get involved.
So what's on the horizon for you and for Donut Economics over the next few years? Is there anything that's about to be launched? Anything that's, you know, kind of interesting that we could get the heads up on?
What I've been spending many months on recently, and I'm really excited about, is working with the international students movement called Rethinking Economics. These are university students today studying economics at university, frustrated by the limitations of the worldview of the course, wanting the economics curriculum to be rewritten in universities. And they reached out to me and they said, we want to be taught donut economics. We want that to be on the curriculum. Can we work together to write resources for a curriculum? So we'll be launching in the autumn online materials that'll be in the commons, as everything that we do goes into the commons, slide decks and lists of readings and videos, with the aim of being available for any university lecturer who says, actually, I would like to start teaching some ecological economics. Where would I begin? Or I want to teach the debate about green growth versus degrowth. Where is the evidence? How do I frame that? It's going to all be in these decks. How do I teach an alternative to rational economic man? How do I teach systems thinking? What would it mean to have the donut as the goal instead of endless growth? So we're going to be putting these into the public domain, hoping that it is available for as many lecturers worldwide to pick up and say, I'm going to start integrating these ideas into my teaching. And of course, students can use them too. So that I'm really excited about.
Well, Kate Raworth, you got a lot on your plate and you're doing some really fascinating work. I thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you. Big pleasure talking to you.
K Kate Raworth is an ecological economist and the author of Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. She was speaking with Rhoda Metcalf. You can also read her article titled A New Compass for Economics in Finance and Development magazine. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, which used to be Twitter, at IMF_podcasts. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.